Did you, and I might send this to you so you could possibly include it as part of the episode, but did you happen to see what Nancy Pelosi said about the TikTok bill?
Awesome. Awesome.
You saw it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tic-tac-toe.
Tic-tac-toe. A winner.
Yeah. So what, so did you like, not okay. Did you like the other one?
Mainstream. No, I did not. Okay. Alec. My girlfriend phrased it to me that like the Coppola family loves to make movies that are just like a vibe, which I think
it's certainly a vibe.
It's certainly a vibe. Yeah. First off, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. It's a rainy day in Lake Charles. Baby slept all night. He's chilling. Hopefully chilling in the bassinet with his mom while she watches soccer. Chelsea's playing in the Premier League.
It was raining here in Houston as well. And there's some really great footage of the rodeo getting rained out and everyone freaking out, which I'm no fan of the rodeo, so I take a little bit of Schadenfreude watching that kind of stuff.
Is that your animal rights activism coming out? Do you think it's cruel to ride bulls and mistreat those poor animals like that?
Yeah, sure. It has nothing to do with my rejection of this like Texas hick mentality. Like,
oh yeah!
Finally, the bullies are getting rained upon.
There's a lot to be said about like appropriation or what. I mean, I don't know. I hate that word so much. Like appropriation of like rural culture, I guess. Like yeah. All these suburbanites who are like, I'm basically a fucking cowboy. I mean, I don't, you know, I've never ridden on a horse, but I own boots and a hat.
Yeah. Don't you do that?
I mean, I do. I am the same. I own boots and hats. Yeah. I can make the excuse that I've been hunting a couple times, but like I've never lived off the land. I don't own it. It's just that comes with like a politics to it, right? About the kind of anybody that's ever shot a gun or gutted a deer. I don't even know if people do that, but like shot a deer out in the woods has this sensibility that they're very close to just calling it quits and living on the land, living off the land, right? Mm-hmm. Fuck the government because I have a gun and I shot a deer one time. And it's like, that is the wrong takeaway, I think, from hunting.
And then
the right takeaway from hunting is it's hard as fuck and you'll probably starve to death.
Yeah. And then come Monday, you're going to have to hop on your regular weekly Zoom call with the other executives of the bank you work at.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. God forbid the air conditioning breaks down in your house and you know, can't fucking survive.
Yeah. Your Tesla has a bumper sticker that says, my other Tesla is a truck.
My other Tesla is a Cybertruck.
Yeah, so, okay, so we are... What do you want to talk about first?
You want to talk about films? Films?
So, welcome to Propagandos. We're talking about social media today. We've got two social media-related movies, and then we'll be moving into a greater discussion of social media in the news. TikTok.
Like all this was kind of brought on by the culture war battle, I guess, and the political battle over whether TikTok should be destroyed by the American state, whether it should be banned in the United States or not. Lots of people talking about that, but we thought we'd analyze a couple pieces of media, right, that seek to analyze social media, I guess, and what it's doing to society.
Yep. So we called each other this week and we were like, I don't know, let's talk about TikTok. Let's find some social media movies. And we kind of just threw some spaghetti at the wall.
We seemingly selected movies at random to view. Although both of these films are trying to say something about.
Yes.
What I would say is like the problem of unreality that social media has kind of projected onto our social interactions, that everybody, including, you know, let's say media elites, right, the kind of people that are able to write and produce and direct movies, also apparently do feel. What do they want you to do about it? Put down your phones or try harder to find good voices, right? Nobody's really dealing with it that well, which makes it all the more kind of interesting, right? Like, at least one of these totally falls flat, and the other one, I think, kind of stops short of saying something really profound, right? So I think you want to introduce them, Connor? You picked them. I watched them.
All right. Should we
to put the blame on you?
should we start with the one we liked or the one we didn't like?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's start with the one we liked.
Okay. So I'm going to be pulling our summaries from Wikipedia today just because we have so much that we want to discuss. And I didn't feel like doing it. So the first one we watched is it's called Not Okay. It's a 2022 American satirical black comedy drama. And it was written and directed by Quinn Shepherd. So, Dani Sandard, played by Zoe Deutsch. Deutsch.
I don't know.
My
wife recognized her.
She's the daughter of Leah Thompson, who's the mom in Back to the Future. So, Dani Sandard is a aspiring writer who works as a photo editor for Depravity, an online magazine in New York City. Struggling with both her job and making friends, Dani, after getting high off a hit from her coworker and social media influencer Colin, whom she has a crush on, lies about attending an upcoming writer's retreat in Paris to impress him. Dani spends the next week posting edited pictures of herself in Paris from her Brooklyn apartment and creates a website for the fake retreat. A few days later, Dani posts an edited photo of herself by the Arc de Triomphe. But a few minutes later, several major Parisian landmarks, including the Arc, are bombed by terrorists. To uphold her lie, Dani claims she witnessed the bombing and fakes returning from Paris, joining up with her parents at the airport. So right out of the bat, I gotta say, I love the premise. I think
very,
it's funny.
Very funny premise. Yeah. Extremely funny premise. So like the opening of the movie, this is just right a relatable millennial kind of loser, right, trying to make their way in a media career that she's kind of failing at, and chooses to take a week off a job that's probably going to fire her, we find out later, and photoshops herself at a bunch of places in Paris to get Instagram likes, and then there's a terrorist attack, and she has to pretend like she was there. She sees the opportunity to take advantage of the trauma inflicted upon her by viewing this, right? And the kind of vapid glomming on that everybody does when something like this happens. A little bit dated in those terms, right? I think I was talking to Connor the other day after we watched it. It reminds me a lot of the real Paris attacks, the 2016 Paris terrorist attack, where everybody posted a filter, you know, a French flag filter on their profile pictures. Feels like a callback to those days. Yeah. And that, to be honest, like, that kind of interest does feel a little bit dated nowadays.
Man, that just reminded me of at one point in time, in order to bring awareness to the missing Romanian women, you know, people were posting black and white photos of them. And once it got to America, the movement became bastardized, and it just became like women posting photos of themselves in black and white as like a way to support each other. And so it just got away from itself. Very, very...
So the film opens up on this lie and then becomes a commentary on activism raising, I suppose, and then, you know, the general, maybe, let's say, unreality of social media. Yeah. And especially something that I'm not particularly in touch with, but I know exists, which is a kind of what I would call like trauma fetishism in social media. The idea that you have clout or are important because of trauma that you've experienced in the real world that redounds to some kind of poignancy of your opinions or increased truth of, let's say, your posts and analysis of society or kind of social importance as a result of that trauma.
Yeah. To contextualize that, I'll plow through the rest of this summary. With her parents, coworkers, and online following believing she is the survivor of the terrorist attacks, Dani immediately garners widespread attention and sympathy, leading Dani to lean into the lie. At a trauma support group, she meets and befriends teenage anti-gun activist Rowan Aldrin, a school shooting survivor who has a large social media following. Inspired by Rowan, Dani writes an article about her experience of being in a terrorist attack. This article, which includes the hashtag #IAmNotOkay, goes viral with Rowan's help and propels Dani to fame. Dani grows closer to Rowan, becoming a confidant and sisterly figure to her. Dani is invited to speak at a rally with Rowan. When counter-protesters set off fireworks, Rowan suffers a PTSD attack and is hospitalized. Meanwhile, Harper, a skeptical co-worker of Dani's, uncovers her deception and gives Dani an ultimatum. Either Harper will announce Dani's fraud to the world, or she can come clean on her own terms. Danny reluctantly decides to publish a short apology detailing the truth and promising to change. This derails her life quickly. She becomes an online pariah, is fired from her job, has her friendship with Rowan tarnished, is forced to move in with her parents after her address gets leaked online by harassers. Danny soon deactivates all of her social media accounts. A month later, Danny is attending a support group for individuals who are victims of online shaming, where she is encouraged, this is a very funny scene, where she is encouraged to make amends with those she hurt. Danny attends a spoken word event where Rowan speaks about how Danny exploited her and that she will never be okay with what Danny did, cementing their destroyed friendship, which impresses Danny and earns cheers from the crowd. Upon realizing that amends would be for her own benefit rather than for Rowan's, Danny quietly exits the theater. Yeah, I really like this movie. It was released in 2022. You can find it on Hulu. Highly recommend watching it. Very, very, very good. I think the things that, to your point earlier, like, it captures that, like, Bushwick millennial veneer of just...
Yeah, she works for a place called, what, Depravity?
Depravity.
Which is like, it's like Distractify. I think it's almost in the same font as one of those. It's not the...
It's like your Gawker, your Jezebel, your Distractify. Like, it's supposed to be an amalgamation of all those kinds of magazines of just like clicks, 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 headlines.
It's like basically a clickbait rag, right? And like the thing that she's the article that she ends up producing that kind of makes her a household name is, you know, all about internalizing your trauma and not hiding it from the world as you continue to post online, right? Something that, by the way, like, it seems like every movie about social media, every piece of media about social media is about trying to not be fake, right? About a kind of purported fictional movement that causes people to like wake up to the fakeness of social media, which seems to be something that, you know, like I say, like all kind of classes seem to be absorbing and trying to metabolize at once, right? Which is the inherent kind of fakeness that social media creates. Being a driving feature for your actions in real life, right? And that kind of having a life of its own. So she meets, right, not Zendaya, the not Zendaya David Hogg character, essentially, right? I feel like this is a direct homage to David Hogg.
I think it's Mia Isaac. I think it is supposed to be, like you said, an homage of David Hogg. I would say it's a pastiche of David Hogg, ex-Gonzalez, different survivors of the Stoneman Douglas shooting and different survivors of shootings who have gone on to be vocal advocates slash activists.
Let's say internet activists, right?
I would not call those people internet activists. They may have some like viral moments, but they are going to like in person.
Sure.
Rally.
Activists like from the internet. I don't know.
Activists who have used the internet to bolster their popularity.
There you go. I think it's like, one of the problems is kind of diminuating real political actors feels bad, right? So to call somebody an internet activist makes them feel like they're only doing stuff on the internet, which I'm not trying to make the claim for, but like, it's clear that a lot of the people that this is characterizing and the people in the film themselves are people from the internet, right? Their interest in them and their voice is driven by the fact that they are, you know, good at posting, right? That they have some understanding of virality, and that they're bolstered by a persona that they put forth on social media sites, right? As opposed to, I don't know, traditional means, right?
Yeah. Well, I think another thing that this movie examines the difference between a very fake online persona and a very real lived experience online persona. Because through the film, we are able to see not just the online persona of both characters, Rowan and Danny, but we also get to see like what they're really like in person. And so online, Danny, you know, a victim of a terrorist attack. Online, Rowan is a victim of a school shooting. In real life, we see Danny as someone who's like, one, ultimately a liar, and two, just like completely tone deaf to other people's lived experiences. Like, there's a really great scene where everyone at work is being really mean to her and shitting on her. And then when she goes to her photo editing department and there's less like one person who's nice to her, she's so shitty to them. So you see like, oh, wherever she is in relation to her place on the pecking order at work. She's just shitty to anyone below her.
I think it's important to point out that while we both probably recommend this movie, I think it's a fun movie to watch. The comedy bits are very good. Like, to the point where the hashtag that they have trending, like, not okay, I was like, was that a real thing? A lot of it poking fun at social media is incredibly real. Everybody in the movie, every character in it is so fucking hateable. Like, yeah. All of her coworkers, the main character herself, Danny, everybody is really, really, really annoying.
And to that point, in test screening, a lot of viewers said, and, you know, this is a bit of trivia I got from the Wikipedia, but people who saw the test screening were really upset that the movie had such an unlikable character. So, in the theatrical release, the director of the film, Quinn Shepherd, who also wrote the film, she added a trigger warning saying they're about to view things that might make them physically or psychologically uncomfortable, including flashing light, themes of trauma, and an unlikable female protagonist, which she did a bit tongue-in-cheek, and boy, did it piss off people at Gawker and The Nation and Twitter.
It's extremely funny. I mean, she's taking the piss out of, like, content warnings in general. By the way, the content warning, like, beautifully kind of comes up before even, like, the production company stingers, right? So before you see, like, you know, Fox, Searchlight, or whatever, there's this content warning. And I think it does a good job in, like, preparing you for what the movie is going to show you, right? How despicable everybody is in the movie, including the main character. I think that was, like, a fun touch.
Yeah.
The fact that it comes after the fact is takes away from it, I think, a little bit, right? The fact that it's kind of like lashing out a bit at the kind of politics of people that viewed the movie. I think the fact that it wasn't planned for from the get-go takes away from it a little bit. Still very funny.
What we could say about the crux of this film is I think it's less critical of social media and more critical of people trying to use social media to pretend to be something that they're not. I think what this movie wants from people and wants us to consider is living a life authentically, not just in person, because we do see Danny acting authentically in her interactions with Rowan, because she hints that, like, she's always wanted a sister and Rowan lost her sister in a school shooting. So there's some real bonding there under the pretext of a lie. But, you know, we get to see two people living an authentic life. And then when we see them online and it's not so authentic, we see the consequences of that in a completely blown out farcical way, which, God, it pays off. It's so
yeah. The movie attempts to transition from a kind of fake setup to back to an authentic experience, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that based upon this lie, these two characters have a friendship that is then undone by the lie, right? But while they have that relationship, it is real. And then the kind of opening premise, the inauthenticity, the appropriation of trauma that is the original lie. By, you know, somebody whose motivations are, I think, largely understandable to an audience, but still doesn't make up for it, right? Undoes the friendship and undoes everything that the lie built, right? So it's a classic kind of rags to riches to rags tale. And I think the interesting thing is that the film tries to say something about the nature of authenticity, right? That all of these movies, all of these pieces of media about social media try to make a statement that either social media is inauthentic writ large, and that authenticity exists in the real world, in quotes, and that we should shy away from social media altogether, or that there's an authentic means by which we can use social media as opposed to an inauthentic way. And I'm not sure that I buy that second premise, right? As a person, I very much believe in the first premise, that social media is fundamentally inauthentic and that the only way to win is to not play, right? I'm a person, by the way. One of my problems with this film is that I don't get a lot of the references because I don't fucking have an Instagram, right? Yeah. So all of this is kind of all of my ability to, like, metabolize messages about Instagram to get the joke is based off of other media I've seen that's making fun of Instagram, or that includes, for instance, like, Instagram in part of the narrative arc. Right, so I'm an outsider to this, but I'm definitely a person that doesn't like or use social media in the way that these people are using it.
Yeah.
So I'm already on that train. The idea that there's a guarded, controlled, and, like, personally chosen way to be authentic on these platforms, I kind of doubt. But then again, I don't live on them, so, you know, take that as you will.
I think it's pretty important to point out that this person, Danny, in the film, it's posting only on Instagram. Because, you know, you use Twitter. We both use Twitter.
Yes.
I use Truth Social as well.
big truth posters in the chat.
But, you know, we use each social media app, and we'll talk about this later in our TikTok discussion, but each social media app serves its own unique purpose.
Different vibes.
Yeah. Instagram is, however, trying to become everything all at once, but it's a mess.
I mean, it should be said that, right, on Twitter, I'm basically anonymous. On Facebook, I'm not, but I barely use that. And I guess I don't think I really use any other social media apps.
In the context of last week's episode, I am also now anonymous and private on Twitter.
I was thinking about this yesterday after watching Not Okay. I think part of my attitude towards this movie and its message comes from the fact that, you know, as I've said before, like, I was a 4chan user for a long, long time. Anonymity is very, very important to me when it comes to internet interactions. And the entire idea of having a life where people look at you and like pictures of you, or the idea that your IRL experience is a means by which you curate these like selected snippets of your life to post online so other people can look at them. All of that's a big turnoff to me, and that makes me a boomer, right, on some level with regard to social media and the realities that people live now, right? I have chose to reject it because anonymity is something that you get bullied for, and it just seems weird to me. So I'm always going to be at odds with it. And by the way, right, when I see something like Okay and it presents, you know, let's say an illegitimate and a legitimate path to activism or to personhood on these apps, right, to being an authentic or inauthentic person through a framing of your Instagram handle, that I discount it writ large. I don't know if I believe that there is an authentic way to be an activist in the way that you know, David Hogg, as a person that I think it's lampooning, does. That's really meaningful. I'm cynical about all that shit.
I used to be a very public person online. I was a performer in town, so I had to promote myself. I had to put myself out there all the time. And then shortly before 2020, thank fucking God, I deleted my entire Facebook. I just got tired of it. And then I removed all photos of myself online. I very, very rarely post photos of myself online. I tried to reject that very public online life that I was living. So I understand where you're coming from with that. And I think we have very, very different experiences and perspectives on social media. But to your point, like, it started to make me feel like I was a fake person. An inauthentic person. So I was like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to delete all this stuff, and I'll lurk on Twitter and very occasionally, like, you know, get mad at Dan Crenshaw or something in the comments. As far as using the internet to bring about effectual change, I got to push back on that. Like, we talked about this last night, and I really gave it a lot of thought. And I do think that every single post helps. Like, you are disrupting the algorithm. You are pushing something to be trending, which cannot be taken away until, you know, executives just flat out go and, like, start deleting content, which could happen. We'll see. But I think that staying online was a way to organize the George Floyd uprising, staying online was a way for us to stay connected over 2020. Staying on, being online and posting online is a way for us to, like, the Aaron Bushnell stuff. That content spreading raised a lot of awareness you could not look away from. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the constant posting of Palestine and the genocide that is going on there is what led to large protest actions, disruptive actions, that, at least as an organizing tool, that leads to, we're now sending aid, albeit not enough, but we are sending aid to Palestine. And it also helped us coalesce, you know, after the Occupy movement into, like, a real social movement that did not work out, did not pan out. But, you know, it brought us the Bernie movement. And I think the dust is still settling in terms of where do we go after the Bernie movement. But I know the DSA has grown from that. So it's these ripple effects. It's these slow. Yeah, I know. The DSA is no real electoral victories yet, but well, I was going to say AOC, but
yeah.
So I do think the internet can be a very useful tool.
I guess my thing is like the internet, you are correct. The internet is an inescapable vector for social interaction. And I'm not sure where, because I guess this entire conversation is about where that begins and ends. If there are individuals that make it their persona online to be defined by an issue, like gun violence, for instance, a la David Hogg. After a while, it might be not surprising that that person feels inauthentic to some, right? That like this glomming on and this celebrity feels as though that person is taking advantage of that trauma, right? Let's say to create a space for themselves as a celebrity. And we'll really never know if that's the case. Like the only way I can decide if that person is legitimate or not is whether or not that social movement achieves its goals. And in light of kind of failures of internet activism, or broadly speaking, right, the left, I'd say, in American politics, part of my cynicism is I see these people become celebrities and then I don't see effectual change in politics. That doesn't mean that the activism is meaningless, right? But it does lead me to kind of roll my eyes a bit more about whether or not, you know, the legitimacy of somebody speaking out because they're a victim of stochastic terrorism, school shootings, for instance,
right?
Or even, you know, police violence on some level is meaningfully defining as a person that should be given, you know, that should be granted, I guess, the social clout that they do.
I have to say, Alec, I'm really blown away by the gall you have of even suggesting that David Hogg, founder of the progressive pillow company Good Pillow, as a way to compete against Mike Lindell's My Pillow, could be seen as inauthentic over time.
You told me that yesterday, and I literally thought it was a bit. I was like, "There's no fucking way."
No.
It's like, "Yep, he did the un-Lindell pillow, non-Lindell my pillow."
Like after getting heckled by Marjorie Taylor Greene shortly before her election. Or winning her election, you know, he was in the good graces of the American public, and I think the last anyone's heard of him is he founded a pillow company to fight against the to trigger the Reds, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, is there more to be said about not okay? There's a fuckboy.
Oh yeah, the hype beast fuckboy is very
funny.
The
hype beast fuckboy white guy character, very funny. Yeah. There's a scene where he lights like a crazy joint.
It takes him probably
the funniest thing in the film.
It takes him so long to light the joint. It's very, very funny.
There's like a joint with like 9 tips on it, and he's got to light every single one. Very, very funny. The bits about her like internal kind of work life are very funny. They've got the kind of the cool kids queer club who are like aesthetically you know more hip than our main character Danny.
Yeah,
and they don't invite her to like the bowling league or whatever,
queer
which is like so
league.
Is so perfectly like millennial work group kind of thing. You know, like incredibly cool, but we still live in Bushwick and our thing is like bowling. Yeah. It's like that's. Very, very good.
I have one more thing to say about Not Okay before we move on to mainstream. And that's at the very end of the movie, Danny does write an apology article and just like publishes it to the website. And she makes an attempt to, you know, absolve herself or gain absolution for her actions. And within the line, because she comes up with the idea to pretend to be in France while she is very high. And in the article, she says, when I did this, I was under the influence of marijuana, which is not an excuse.
It's just so perfect.
It nails the like online milkshake duck apology. It is so good.
They had some very good writing on this. I will grant them that. If I have to criticize it, it's that the final scenes about, I guess, embracing your cancellation and depersonalizing and just not engaging, being like becoming a lurker on the internet as opposed to an active participant. I think that's a true message, right? I think if you get canceled in the way that some of our faves have, let's say, I don't know, people that we're aware of on the internet have got canceled. I think it probably is the right move to just say this chapter of my life is ended and it's time for me to go away forever. But what that proffers is a legitimation of the other side, right? So the idea that there are people that are license to be aggrieved by their own personal experiences as opposed to yours, I do take umbrage with, because the ultimate politics that the movie's trying to portray are universal, right? So your participation in it is kind of necessary and needed. And if it wasn't, then the idea would be that all of this is useless and pointless, and we should all, I don't know, do DSA politics instead of posting on Instagram. But it's not, right? The film, and I think the filmmakers and, you know, the view of politics that they have is that we should participate. But if you're an illegitimate source of, if your trauma is illegitimate, right? If your trauma is, I'm an underemployed millennial and just shit sucks for me, that doesn't rise to the occasion of a kind of social political consideration by society, right? By the internet society, and that other people's does. And I don't, that just seems kind of vapid to me. That doesn't seem to be the right take either, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to mainstream. Ugh, this shit show. Okay.
Mainstream is another beautifully selected movie by Connor. I think there's actually quite a bit to say about it. The good thing about mainstream is it's basically impossible to watch anywhere. So if you're listening to this, you can't watch mainstream. I think Connor paid Google money to view it.
I bought this for $15.
It's basically been scrubbed from the internet. Which, by the way, I said that Battle at Lake Changjin was baffling on the last episode. This movie feels like a tax dodge. It's fucking crazy that this got made. Somebody spent $5 million, or a group of people spent $5 million to make this. Unbelievable,
yeah,
that this was made.
People spent $5 million to make it, and a larger group of people spent $40,000 to go see it. So it was a massive bomb. This is directed by Gia Coppola, the granddaughter of Francis Ford Coppola. So this is a classic. I mean, Jason Schwartzman's cast in this movie. So this is a classic example of Coppola's keeping Coppola's hired. Like, they keep them working.
So Andrew Garfield's like...
Andrew Garfield, Maya Hawke, daughter of Uma
Thurman. So Maya Hawke's no... She's no small actress either. She was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She was one of the hippies. Among all of, like, the Nepo babies that were all the kind of hippie group in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Maya Hawke's in there too.
Yeah. Johnny Knoxville's in this. Look, I want to say that... And you may disagree with me, but I want to say up top, I don't think anyone did a bad performance in this movie. The performances are not what made this movie suffer.
Andrew Garfield is trying his best to be a schizophrenic homeless person. That's basically the setup for his character. The performances are pretty good. The shockingly, like, the cinematography, the setups, right? It's like well filmed and directed. It's got a good, it's competently shot. Right, I should say. Famously, I remember this movie because there's an editing mistake that was referenced in a Red Letter Media video in like 2020. And I remembered that and went and saw the video. There's like a literal editing mistake in the film.
Okay.
She like walks out of the basement to go talk to him. And there's like a 5-second bit where like the audio is correct, but they just have the wrong shot inserted. So I went back and I watched the Red Letter Media thing. And sure enough, it was mainstream that he was talking about.
I wonder if that was intentional. You don't think so?
I don't think it's intentional.
I don't know what the proper name for that kind of cinematic technique is. I've seen stuff like that done in like Mandy, the Nicolas Cage film. Okay, so let's read the synopsis for mainstream. This is a 2020 film.
Do we have to? We can just describe it.
All right.
It's the closest thing to a movie that's actually schizophrenic, right? Like when I was done with it, I had a profound feeling like after watching Lynch, right? Like it makes everything else feel unreal.
Interesting. Well, that's kind of a theme of the film. So here we go. Frankie, played by Maya Hawke, is a young filmmaker living in West Hollywood. She is working a thankless job bartending with her friend Jake, played by Nat Wolff, and has no clear vision of her goals other than creating a struggling YouTube channel. One day, she encounters Link, Andrew Garfield, an eccentric young man working as a costume mascot in a mall. When Frankie claims to have been filming a painting behind Link and not Link himself, Link grabs the painting and performs a rambling but passionate monologue, urging passersby to pay attention to the art. Frankie records the monologue and uploads it, where it quickly becomes her most popular video. Frankie later re-encounters Link by chance and befriends him. The often manic Link claims that his parents are dead and that he is firmly anti-establishment and anti-social media. Frankie asks Link to appear in more of her videos. He agrees, as long as she quits her dead-end job. She convinces Jake to join them as a writer. Together, the team make a video called No One Special, starring Link as a satire of a stereotypical, loud, offensive, narcissistic social media influencer. At a late-night party hosted at a graveyard, Jake privately witnesses Link arguing with someone who claims to be his brother, but does not bring it up to Frankie. Frankie, Jake, and Link launch a show called Your Phone or Your Dignity, in which Link, as No One Special, takes contestants' smartphones and offers to give them a dumb phone or to return their own phone if they undergo a humiliating task. After initial success, the trio falls victim to infighting when they begin to lose views. The tension comes to a head when Link humiliates a young woman, Isabel, on the show by revealing that she edits a facial birthmark out of her selfies. Under his pressure, she agrees to release her unedited photos for the game show prize, but breaks down in tears, for which he aggressively admonishes her. Upset at what the show has become, Jake quits. Link is then invited to be on a roundtable with several other internet celebrities hosted by Ted Wick, but when he is accused by Ted of hypocrisy and confronted with the unedited footage of Link's humiliation of Isabel, Link rants against the other participant, claims that Isabel tried to seduce him, and is thrown out for pretending to defecate on stage. Disillusioned, Frankie visits Jake at their old workplace and tries to bring him back into the fold, but Jake refuses and reveals he has done research on Link and found out that he is a liar. He is actually a son of rich parents who are both alive, and that he is dangerous and unstable, having once been institutionalized for burning down his school. Link arrives and announces that YouTube has invited him to head a live stream event and that he wants to do it with her, and she accepts. While setting up for the live stream, Frankie learns that Isabel died by suicide due to her humiliation of her appearance and Link's accusations. When Link is more concerned about his public image than her death, Frankie reveals she knows the truth about him and storms out. During the live stream, which includes a memorial for Isabel, Link gives his condolences, but then veers off-script into a manic, vulgar monologue, refusing to accept blame for her death and instead ranting against the toxicity of social media and its oppressive hold over its audience. As he departs the stage, the gathered crowd applauds and starts chanting his name as he turns and smiles at the camera. Maybe I can say this later, but yes, the audience eats him up when he goes manically off-script, similar to Trump, and we get to see a authentic version, so the audience responds to his authenticity more than the character he's putting on, which I thought was an interesting way to end the film. But this movie sucked.
This movie's really terrible. I mean, it's like I said, it's like baffling. We've like read the plot synopsis on Wikipedia, and I have to say that a lot of this is not presented. It's kind of implied, but the movie carries on from shot to shot with a kind of disdain for realism that makes it feel actually schizophrenic, meaning there's not like all of the plot elements that connect one scene to the next, which makes it fucking crazy to watch. It's crazy that this ended up, right, with this cast and with this production, ended up like this, I suppose. Maybe this was an executive choice to make it like this, but it is truly baffling and weird.
I think it was an executive choice. I mean, there's a lot of like intentional glitching whenever they're making their online videos. It's shot very manically, and it's like very short shots, very fast edits. There's one part where
the editing is like frenetic, and they put like emojis over everything, out of nowhere it'll transition from a scene where we're kind of talking, it feels real, to we're in a video and there's like emojis bouncing everywhere and stuff. It's really hard to look at. Very hard to watch.
I was saying, I was about to say there's a scene where Maya Hawke throws up into a sink and it's just emojis falling out of her mouth. Really weird. I thought the trailer looked incredible, which is why I wanted to watch it. And
you thought it might be like a hidden gem?
Yeah, I thought like, okay, this is this. Yeah, I did. I thought like, okay, there's a Coppola attached to this. Maybe this will be really awesome.
Well, like I said, I mean, the production of it's like pretty high quality. Yeah. I mean, it should be said, I think, that like the narrative itself, right, just like nakedly looking at kind of the plot that the movie presents, it feels like what a boomer thinks that social media and, you know, internet celebrity is. That it, like, the kind of setup to them getting big on YouTube almost felt like the super early days of YouTube, like 2009, 2010, right, where like anything that had any quality to it or any virality just like exploded out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, where we get a lot of even the current kind of YouTube celebs, right? They're people that started out making these videos super early on when there basically was no content,
yep,
and then it burgeoned into this, there's no reason why in the year 2020, somebody making like quote unquote random videos as they like, you know, cut up in like West Hollywood would have exploded like this.
You're right. It's definitely harkening back to like an earlier day of YouTube. The film dance on social media, I still haven't been able to glean. I'm very, it left me like really confused. And maybe that's what they wanted. Maybe that's a good thing for them. I don't know. But
social media bad. Camera's bad. iPhone's bad.
Yeah. I think it reminded me, there's a Black Mirror episode, 15 million merits. So the Black Mirror episode, 15 million merits, the way how that ends with the character Bing getting his own show after he stands up to the oppressive system and threatens to kill himself on camera. He's given his own show where he's like perpetually threatening to kill himself. And so that's what the ending of this reminded me of just Link has become the thing that he rails against, but he's making money, so I don't think he cares. And like I said, like when he goes off script and gives this manic speech, the audience really, really responds to him. So is the movie saying it's better to be authentic online? Is the movie saying social media is bad? Is it good? Is it fake? Does it fucking matter? One thing I do know is that the movie is definitely critical of social media influencers and the rat race of creating content. And yet there are so many social media influencers in the film. And that really stood out to me. Do you know what the movie is about? Do you care what the movie is about? Is this just another paycheck to you? Because the social media influencer pivot is such a real thing of just like staying relevant, getting that paycheck, staying with your sponsors at all costs.
I think everybody wants to say something about social media because it's so important to our lives, and everybody feels the kind of weird unreality that it makes us live in. But I think this film and its production, I can only imagine and kind of glean from the people that are in it and the choices that it makes. Is a movie like crafted by people that live in Hollywood, right? That which is like where all the influencers and shit live now. It's funny that you bring up a Black Mirror episode, which basically does this film, but let's say better, like 10 years before this movie gets made, because the weird kind of aesthetic, like thematic choice that it makes where it transitions between reality and unreality is like La La Land. It reminded me exactly of La La Land's ability to transition from like the musical kind of theatrical setting to these more toned down realistic scenes, right? Like these interpersonal scenes where they have conversations. And for some reason, like in La La Land as a musical, especially like making fun of like Hollywood and life in Hollywood, it works better. Right, I'm not a huge fan of La La Land, but like it's a thematic choice that works better for that movie. It feels like they watched that and were like, well, we'll make this about YouTube. And it's just does not work. It falls apart at every level.
Yeah, do you think it's effective either in real life or within this film to just like use YouTube as a platform to tell people to stop looking at YouTube? Because the characters of the film want people to log off, and yet when they start getting less views, they start losing their fucking mind.
That occurred to me in the movie, and then the movie itself comments on it. They do a bit where like he goes on a talk show and some guy's like, isn't you getting a bunch of subscribers? And then, oh, by the way, right, like Andrew Garfield's character, his first kind of bit is to get everybody to throw their phones away. So, you know, this guy internally in the movie even brings it up, right, which is, isn't it weird that you're getting all these subscribers, but, you know, getting people to throw their phones away? Like how is that consistent? And by the way, like to the internal logic of the movie, how are they watching him if the point is, if he's successful, they throw all their phones away and then nobody watches him?
Yeah. It sounds like he doesn't want the success. He just wants the message out there. Again, this movie, if you listen to that Wikipedia plot, like it's a good story, great performances. The editing, I think, is really what killed this fucking film for me. It is just so disjointed.
It feels like this got lost in writing somewhere, right? Like somebody wrote a kind of generalized plot and then was like, well, we'll keep up with the times by leaving it loose and by doing a lot of like ad-libbing on stage or whatever. And then it just got way, way the fuck out of hand until it's this, you know, really bad improv slap together, you know, thing.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the problems with this. Maybe this is a problem with the Coppolas. I definitely have voiced this concern to you or complaint to you about Wes Anderson, is that auteurs usually get to do whatever they want and don't get like rewrite notes, and it shows.
Yeah.
Hated Asteroid City. My God.
You know, it's, I mean, Jason Schwartzman's in that. Maya Hawke is in Asteroid City, by the way.
That's
so there's
right.
a lot of crossover between, you know, that movie. I thought Asteroid City was kind of cute in the way that all the Wes Anderson movies are kind of cute. But I definitely know where Connor's coming from. It's Wes Anderson doing an impression of Wes Anderson right at this point, or an impression of an impression of Wes Anderson. He's become so formulaic that,
I just didn't like the framing of everything around that play that was being produced. It was so whatever. We saw it together, and we did. And Alec walked out like, that was pleasant. And I'm like, that was a piece of shit.
You know, every time it's been 5 years and I see another Wes Anderson movie, I'm reminded that I kind of liked a bunch of his earlier stuff. It just makes me want to go watch, A Life Aquatic again.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this was cute. Wasn't Life Aquatic good? And everybody's like, boo, we hate this shit now.
I like
because I've missed Aquatic. I think I've missed like 5 Wes Anderson movies in between other ones.
I've seen all of them except for the short films he did on Netflix. Just because I was like, I'm all right, and I have zero interest in watching.
I've seen enough of this shit. Well, yeah, like that's what's consistent, I think, between the two movies. Bizarrely, right? Is everybody's social media has affected us so much that everybody feels kind of alienated from it, and everybody's trying to say something about it, but nobody knows what to say. Because fundamentally, you can't really critique. You can't if your effective critique of social media is that everybody shouldn't be on it. That's not really workable, right? It's such a cornerstone of modern society that getting off of it is just not an acceptable answer. And so, in the same way that people push kind of individualist actions about things like climate change, right? That goodness in that sphere when there's no kind of overarching social change, when the government can't ban us from being on our phones and posting on Instagram, then the answer is for you as an individual to be better on Instagram. And I think that that falls flat, right? That's not something that anybody truly believes can happen. Or it just feels kind of weak as an argument.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. I don't think it's as simple. I mean, you can get off Instagram and you can get off social media the way to maybe incrementally improve your own life, but in terms of like a systemic change to the world itself, no, I don't think that's effective. In fact, I think it's counter-effective. Like, I think the internet is, as I said before in the episode, I think it's a really good organizing tool, a tool to bring us together. So, like, I don't know, use the internet better.
And I mean, Connor's criticism is also correct. If the point of talking about stuff on social media is eventually to do something political and social media is bad, well, what the fuck does activism and political organizing even look like without something like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or TikTok? I don't have the answer to that. I don't fucking know. Low-level local politics is still a thing that is fundamentally influenced by and organized through these same tools, right, that kind of use them cynically for profit.
Yeah.
So how do you get away from it? I don't fucking know.
I think it's probably worth pointing out that like the normal tools for organizing have evaporated, and therefore we have to move to the internet. So like you're not really going to the local coffee shop to post a flyer. You know, it's been replaced by a Starbucks that does not allow you to post a flyer of like an upcoming protest or a rally. So we have to use it.
Structures for organizing, structures for reporting, structures for for journalism, for even political advocacy from political actors, right, from politicians, is now structured through social media.
Yeah.
So it's fundamentally inescapable. I mean, until we get hit with like a solar flare EMP and everybody's phones just brick overnight and we go back to, you know, the 19th century, there is no turning off social media.
No.
So media that's seeking to critique it on that level and say like, you know, you should make the personal decision to use it better or not use it at all, are always going to kind of land flat.
Well, there is something that we can do about social media.
Yes, there is a group of American individuals
yes.
that is trying to do something about social media.
And that is, we could outright ban the fucking thing.
Get rid of it.
Look, we got to talk about the TikTok ban, and I don't know where to start, but I can say right off the top, don't worry about the TikTok ban. I'll put some money on it. I bet $100 it ain't going anywhere. The bill has already been sent to committee in the Senate, which is just like a death knell for this thing. And Jeff Yass is a big time investor in TikTok, as well as like the top donor for the election cycle in the GOP this year. He doesn't want TikTok to go anywhere. So Trump,
he's been Yassified.
Yeah.
Jeff Yass. What fucking kind of name is that? Oh, I'm sorry.
Trump has been Yassified because Donald Trump himself has now backed off of the TikTok ban that he tried to initiate, saying that if we ban TikTok, Meta will just be even more powerful than we could ever imagine, which I think is kind of the impetus behind this TikTok ban.
You hate it when the man's right, dude. It sucks.
Yeah. So I can give a little brief rundown. I can talk about how it started. In January 2019, there was a post on the Peterson Institute of International Relations that pointed out some TikTok security concerns. It didn't just blame TikTok. It was a few degrees right of nuanced, where it was pointing out to like, hey, look, Facebook hasn't really stepped up in any way to like fix all the data selling and data sharing. But, you know, we should also be mindful of this other app that's based in another country that has different laws, different rules. That is then taken and the GOP run with it. So later that year in May 2019, Trump issued the Executive Order 13873, which is focusing on communication software and technology run by foreign adversaries. So this is the beginning of the TikTok and Huawei conversation. And then these executive orders and the Peterson Institute are cited by Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley and are entered into the congressional record. As,
two of our faves.
Yeah, so it's now on record that there's a danger around TikTok. And these quotes from Rubio and Hawley are then picked up by the mainstream media and they're run with. And a thing that's called securitization theory, which is how do you elevate something from a low-level policy issue to a national threat? And we see this with immigration. We see this with the opioid epidemic. And all of these all connect to the existential threat of China. And so what's the problem with the border? Oh, people are bringing fentanyl into the country. Where's the fentanyl coming from? China. Oh, okay. So what's going on with TikTok? Oh, China. China's stealing our data. Oh, okay. So we should get rid of it then. So then Trump issues Executive Order 13942, and this is in August 2020, specifically targeting TikTok. And Trump is, you know, voted out of office, and we think, okay, it's going to end there, right? Wrong. And Biden's administration, that is when actual legislation is signed, and Biden signs the No TikTok on Government Devices Act in 2022. And others...
No TikTok on Blackberries.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here.
So within 2022, and I've been having some trouble kind of lining this up on the timeline here, but Meta, Facebook's parent company, hired Targeted Victory, which is a Republican PR firm, to spread lies about TikTok, including the Slap a Teacher Challenge, which is a rumor that was started on Facebook. There's no video. It's just so funny to be like, it's called the Slap Your Teacher Challenge, and your kids are slapping their teachers.
Everything's like about the knockout game, right?
Yes. And so Targeted Victory worked with dozens of PR firms across the country to sway public opinion against TikTok. And then this is when this bill gets to Biden's desk. He signs it. And now here we are 2 years later in 2024, and the House overwhelmingly passes a bill to either ban TikTok from app stores, which I don't know if it means I'd still be able to use the app if I have it on my phone. It's a little unclear. I read the bill. It's not quite clear. Or ByteDance, the company that owns TikTok, has 6 months to divest and sell it off to a foreign party, which, hey, Alec, do you know who's like the number one guy who might be able to buy it? Steve Mnuchin, Trump's Treasury Secretary.
Way.
Yep, Steve Mnuchin is trying to form a coalition to buy TikTok. And before that, it was another Trump buddy who was, I forget the guy's name, but he was the guy in charge of Oracle, a database company.
That's strange, because I figured this would just be a kind of naked sell directly to Meta or Microsoft or, you know, one of the big institutional tech players.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have imagined that there'd be like a consortium of, you know, Truth Social posters that are going to get together the requisite capital to buy something off of ByteDance that's worth, I mean, I don't know. Was TikTok? I assume it's in the billions.
Yeah,
right?
It's the largest social media app in the world right now. And I did want to touch a little bit on securitization theory, because that timeline shows you how the government over a long period will talk about something to the point where it becomes a national threat, and then that affects us, the audience. They have to use the right rhetoric to convince us it's a national threat, and then the government's able to do almost whatever they want in order to achieve those means.
They also have to sell this internally to a system of regulation that is, you know, in my opinion, right, both parties are kind of fundamentally opposed to at a large level, right? At a large scale, nobody wants to see the federal government the federal government bolstered in its efforts to do regulation on private business, right? So you got to be really careful in the way that you structure these attempts at corporate control. But one of the ways you can do it, right, that this button, that the only button that they have, right, which is a button that they keep pushing, is national security. Mm-hmm. Everything that's been a political issue that seems to be on track to have something done about it, you might notice, is a national security threat of some kind.
Yes.
Right? It's the one button they have, and they're going to fucking keep pushing it because it's the only thing that, you know, whether it's a complaints about bipartisanism, it's the only thing that both parties can sell mm-hmm. to a public or to themselves, right? As a reasonable means by which the federal government can act, or it's, and I think both are true in their own ways. It's one of the only ways by which the structure can act upon itself.
Yeah, and why securitization theory is used in this issue is because China is that existential threat. And in all the discourse that's being done about it, it is China has your data. China can manipulate your data. It's never American companies have your data.
At the very least, that's the angle that we've convinced ourselves of, right? Like, kind of not talked about enough in this conversation is the fundamental reality that Chinese trade is fundamental to the American economy, and of countries that are not, you know, physically right next to us, it's, you know, a strategic trading partner for so many of our goods. And Congress is labeling them an existential enemy of the United States. A bit schizophrenic, I'd say. I don't know if we can metabolize that reality, right? Like, I don't know if that's something that that the American public or the American political structure is able to really justify in those terms.
Well, within the context of the bill, they say they do call out ByteDance and TikTok, but they also broaden this to all foreign adversaries and controlled countries. Controlled countries is the key term. And what I want you, the listener, to be aware of is that that means that this does not stop at China. This means that you will not be able to download any apps that are created by citizens or the country, the governments of the Russian Federation, the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, or Iran.
I don't know if the DPRK was making a TikTok clone. If so, I would love to be on it. I would love to see what, like, Iranian or like North Korean Twitter looks like. That would be sick.
It would be sick. I would want to get on the Russian version of Truth Social. That's what I want.
The Putin app.
It's one of those things where, like, you just got to read the bill and read the definitions of the bill to see, like, what this is really about. It is not about protecting your data at all. This is about China has the largest social media app in the world, and we don't want that. There are some people who are claiming that this is in response to TikTok being used as a way to spread protest actions and awareness of protest actions. I don't necessarily buy that narrative, and only because being on Instagram, I see nothing but this content. So I do think this is about China.
I think all of that is true to some degree.
Yeah.
Right. There's obviously a long-standing concerned effort by tech giants to chase out foreign competition.
Right.
And by the way, included in that are the capital firms, right, that finance a lot of Silicon Valley kind of tech business, right? All those people want, as China as a large owner, kind of gone out of that space, either because they want to consolidate that part of the market share, or they think it's unfair that they're granted, you know, specific consideration by the Chinese government at a kind of infancy stage. There's a struggle between international sectors of tech investment and business that are probably at the core of what becomes eventually the TikTok bill. But it should not go without saying that TikTok specifically, as a vector for content that is not, that is more difficult, I should say, for the American state to massage, you know, not necessarily control, but to prune. If you were on Facebook at the time of the breakout, for instance, of the Ukraine war, certain topics for Facebook groups, I would say even, let's say, tame considerations granted to, you know, like, I'm by no means like a big fan of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but talking about it, I think, in even kind of neutral terms on Facebook and certain like Facebook groups, for instance, would threaten like deletion of those Facebook groups early on in that conflict, right? Certainly the same can be said about the spreading of pro-Palestinian messaging was actually threatened with deletion on Facebook. I don't think there's any right disagreement about that. The means of control is a serious consideration when it comes to various lobbies in Washington. And, you know, let's not kid ourselves, right? AIPAC and the Israel lobby is one of the big ones. So the idea that that the TikTok bill kind of resurfaces and gains steam and ends up not only in the public discourse, but as something that Biden basically says that he'll sign into law if passed in the kind of aftermath of October 7th and the war in Gaza, right? The genocide in Gaza, let's just say. I don't think that's by accident, right? I think this is a real frustration for large lobby powers in Washington, and that they are definitely one of the groups that's kind of pushing for this continued relevance of this kind of action.
I guess my question there, like to tie it back, is then why is AIPAC not trying to lobby Facebook to just delete all content that is pro-Gaza, pro-Palestine?
I think these groups are still affected by a kind of public perception, and I think the reality was they responded pretty critically. The critical response to shutting down discourse about Palestine, for instance, was pretty vocal in the early days.
Yeah.
And I think that literally did affect, right, how Facebook responds to continued desire for it to be more heavily policed, right? Like, for instance, there was quite a bit of public frustration in left circles about Facebook, for instance, shutting down conversations of like the Rohingya genocide in Myanmar. But because it was not a large enough like domestic audience, I don't know if it created as big of a backlash. The pro-Palestine stuff has become so loud with constituencies, let's just be honest, right? American constituencies, that I don't know if they could continue with a censorship campaign on Facebook, the likes of which AIPAC would prefer.
Right. Yeah, I guess it could also be the fact that like TikTok is just like running laps around Meta.
Yeah, the success of TikTok has a lot to do with it, right? Like, yeah. Meta's not happy that TikTok is successful. The American right wing, for instance, right? If you look at what young people post on social media and let's say like the general social tendencies of the young generation being, you know, let's say more sexually liberated, that in itself pisses off a huge constituency of the American right. It's just clear that there's certain kinds of narratives that fly on TikTok that don't on other social media platforms.
Yeah.
Right.
One of which, the inverse of that is something that you absolutely cannot talk about on TikTok, but you can talk about on many other apps, is what happened in Tiananmen Square.
True.
Which
is odd because as far as I understand it, TikTok doesn't exist. That TikTok, right? The TikTok that we're on isn't the same one that they're on in China. I never understood the Tiananmen Square thing.
I have no idea what's going on with that, man. Are you on TikTok? Do you ever look at it?
No, not really.
So I got to say, I never see anything political on TikTok. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but my algorithm is all about like, here's a big pig running through a field of grass. Look at this big pig, or like video game content. So maybe it knows what I want. Maybe it is trying to not give me political information. I'm not 100%. All I see on Instagram is constant, countless posts that are just like, this content is being censored. I'm being censored. This is censored. And it's just like, I don't know if it is being censored. The algorithm of Facebook and Meta does suck. I'm not going to lie about that. But like, in terms of censorship, I'm not 100% on that.
That's something we should touch on, right? Which, like, is TikTok substantially better than these other social media platforms? I don't think so. I don't know that it's that much better, no. Right? It sucks that this is another stepping stone in like the continued seemingly consolidation of everything that we use on the internet, right? It seems like Meta is just going to own everything at some point.
Yeah. I'll say I don't think TikTok is the best because in order to actively engage with it, you do have to sacrifice your anonymity. Like if you want to post on it, unless you don't show your face or don't show your voice, I mean, you can do it a little bit, but like not everybody wants to have their face online. Not everybody wants to talk into a camera. It's also like the majority of my time using social media is when I'm like in the bathroom. And so like I don't want to have to take my headphones. I don't want to have to like turn my Bluetooth on just to be able to like look at my phone. That's why I love Twitter. That's why I used to love Instagram because it was just pictures. And now it's Reels. Now, to touch on your other point about Meta just like buying up everything. Look, it tried to buy Snapchat. Snapchat said no dice. And so then it introduced Instagram stories, which are 24-hour posts. And then they're disappeared. But you can, or I got China on the brain saying disappeared. They're removed from your story feed, basically. And then it wanted to buy TikTok, no dice. So then it, and keep in mind, Instagram was not originally a Facebook company. Facebook bought it. And then they adapted some of Snapchat's mechanism. And then with TikTok, they have tried to capture that by introducing Instagram Reels. And now if you look at Instagram, it's just Reels, Reels, Reels. This photo app is now a video app. And it sucks. I hate Instagram so much. Now, what I wanted to ask you about this is because Trump's saying that if TikTok is banned, Meta will become stronger than ever before. I cannot help but think, and I know we mentioned this movie a lot, I cannot help but think about the ending of Sound of Freedom when Jim Caviezel is directly talking to the audience and he says basically that like, no matter, like, sex trafficking is happening no matter what Hollywood or politicians or the tech billionaires tell you. And so there's a distrust of tech billionaires that makes me wonder, like, okay, is Trump appealing to like a populist anti-tech billionaire, anti-Mark Zuckerberg vein in order to gain votes and support? Or is this really just like Jeff Yost?
Oh, yeah. I mean, flipping like, him. Do these people actually have a problem with social media? I would say Trump does. Trump has real history with Facebook, right? Which is that he was, let's say, I actually do believe this. He was a bit unduly slandered for the Russiagate stuff involving the purchase of Facebook ads that were purportedly to advance his presidential campaign. His very real beef with Facebook as like a social media platform notwithstanding, I think Trump's reading the room in the general distrust of tech as a class. I think there is a lot of truth to that, and I think a lot of Trump voters, and I think a lot of voters in general are all going to be receptive to the message that TikTok or Facebook or Snapchat or whatever is bad. And yeah. And Zuckerberg is, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, given that, you know, Facebook seems to be a kind of a particularly fecund environment for right-wing crazies. Facebook and Zuckerberg are particularly unpopular with the Trump crowd.
Yeah. I also think that maybe, so Vivek Ramaswamy, once known for calling TikTok digital fentanyl, is now on TikTok, is in favor of TikTok. He also has connections to Jeff Yost. But I do think Vivek and Trump, to your point about reading the room, so I met at a conference, I met Dr. Michael McCluskey from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and he and Nagwan Zari wrote a paper on TikTok securitization theory and public opinion. And what they found in their research was that, like, basically the people who believe that TikTok is a national security threat are older Republicans who are not on TikTok. Younger people who are on TikTok do not think it's a national security threat. And I think politicians such as Vivek and Trump may be seeing, like, hey, TikTok can be a very valuable tool to, like, reaching out to the youth and getting that youth vote because, you know, it's an election year. Why would you do away with the digital infrastructure to like build votes and get votes.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, will they feel this way after Election Day this year? I don't know. And anyone who says they know is a fucking liar.
I have to assume that part of it is that this is going to be seen as like a Biden L, right? That this is pissing a lot of people off, young people or older people, right? That censorship, which this, you know, on some level is going to be unpopular, and just making a politically astute a decision to run against it, right, is got to be at least part of this. I don't know if there's any particular love for TikTok by like the Trump campaign. Maybe they're getting paid under the table, right? Maybe ByteDance or whoever has figured out which way the wind is blowing in terms of who's going to be pushing for them getting banned. You know, maybe it's just a lot simpler than that.
Yeah.
So I was gonna ask real quick, is there anything in particular that tells you that the TikTok bill is not something to worry about? When you say like, it's probably not going to pass, don't worry about it. Is there any special knowledge you'd like to share about why you think that?
Two things. One is that it's been sent to committee in the Senate, and like, sorry, but when a bill gets sent to committee, that's just a fancy way of saying like, nope, they don't want to think about it anymore.
Is it reconciliation committee, or is it, this might not be interesting, but usually, right, when a bill passes the House, the Senate will pass a version of it, and then they both get sent to a reconciliation committee so that they can kind of iron out differences and argue over what parts of it are important, right?
It's not reconciliation committee. I forget what committee, but it's not to that point. It's just kind of like being swept under the rug so they can review the House bill and make sure that they do everything by the book. And even Ted Cruz has just been like, we'll see. We want to look into it. And if Ted Cruz is like tempering the TikTok conversation, like, all right, that's a pretty good indicator of where the shit's headed. And sure, also, yeah, like I said earlier, like Jeff Yoss, he has like over $1 billion invested into TikTok.
I can't stop thinking of Yas Queen.
Well, that's the thing, is that the episode title is going to be called The Jeff Yossification of TikTok. Or perfect. The Jeff Yossification of the TikTok bill. But Jeff Yoss is the number one political donor of this election cycle, and Trump campaign is cash strapped. And Yoss is bankrolling this campaign. Basically, everyone's bending the fucking knee to Trump. And if Trump is the one saying like, hey, we need to keep TikTok or otherwise the tech billionaires are going to get stronger and stronger. Yeah, I would say that's a good litmus test on like this bill's survivability. I don't think it's going to happen. And I do think that, you know, there are people on the right who are probably waiting for the time to be right for them to say like Democrats in the Senate, because Democrats hold the Senate, but Democrats in the Senate killed the TikTok bill. We're the only people who care about TikTok bill.
Oh, yeah. Blah, that blah, pivot blah. Is definitely coming.
Yeah, the pivot's coming. And it could be, you know, what I think would be really funny is if Trump won in 2024, and instead of banning TikTok, he just bans everything but Truth Social.
You know what? That's the kind of visionary political thought that could actually solve the problem that everybody has of social media being bad.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be the through line of all of this shit, right? Of these two movies that are, one's, what, about 4 years old, the other one's about 2 years old, mm-hmm. and then the kind of final fruition of this scheme of regulation that seeks to ban TikTok and whatever in its current form, or make it sold, or whatever, like whatever ends up happening with that, is that everybody seems to hate social media. They hate the way that it influences society, the way that they're viewed on it or pushed to be viewed on it, and that the effects that it's having on kids and everybody's behavior, down to, you know, taking pictures of food at restaurants. Everybody hates all that shit. We don't even like using the social media platforms that much, but we're addicted to them. And then somebody tries to do something about it by banning, you know, one of them. I don't know if it's the worst one, but it's certainly one of them. And everybody's up in arms that uses that platform, that they're taking away my, you know, my soda and not yours, mm-hmm. right? They're banning menthol cigarettes, but not, you know, Zen pouches or Marlboro Reds or whatever, yes. right? There is no regulation that can undo the things that social media has done to us outside of, you're right, banning everything but Truth Social. We're all going to become Truth users, and we'll all be better off for it.
And that's the thing. Like, I really hate the fact that this is, like, instead of a regulation of how people use the internet, because I believe, like, they've tried to say like, oh, TikTok is manipulating our teens. It's like, well, in China, this existential threat that you keep talking about, teens are limited to like 2 hours of screen time a day. Would you consider doing that? Fuck no. This is America. We're just going to ban something instead of even remotely attempt to regulate something.
Well, on the flip side, China also fundamentally prevents you from posting certain things on social media, right? Like, I don't know, maybe we'll cut that. Maybe we want to talk about that on another episode, whether it's good or not to, if you like the ideology of the government and you trust them, is it okay for them to literally just neuter certain conversations on the internet so that they don't, you know, rile up the kind of proles, whether or not that's acceptable or not?
I don't know.
You know, mileage may vary.
That is definitely a much longer conversation, because we've joked before of like, is it worth it to have the freedom of speech to complain about how bad everything is?
So with that, I think, does that wrap things up for this week?
Yeah, I've got nothing. Follow us on Twitter. at Propagandos Pod. We are not on TikTok. We are not on Instagram. Just Twitter. As horrible as that landscape has become, it's still the best social media platform as far as I'm concerned.
Look, if Connor wants to do it, we can make a Blue Sky account. He can run our Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook accounts. If he wants to take those over, I run the Twitter account, which means I barely fucking do anything on that motherfucker.
I don't even know what we would put on it. Unless we started doing video clips, I don't know what we'd even put on Instagram.
Then we'd have to record our faces or, you know, overlay some shit while we talk.
Oh, well, it looks like a...
Sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, I could always wear a Guy Fawkes mask or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of fun watching Not Okay. And then... But I didn't like it. And then watching Mainstream, I was just like, holy shit, that other movie's fucking great.
Yeah, I watched Mainstream first, and maybe that's why I was like, Not Okay is awesome.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. It's so good.
I also thought that, like, one thing about Not Okay, and this is what I really like, is when a movie has, like, there's no deus ex machina in the plot. Like, Matt Stone and Trey Parker put it once as, like, a good story structure. This happens, but this happens, therefore this happens. So Danny really wants to impress this guy. So she smokes a joint that he provides her and gets way too high, and then comes up with the idea while high to pretend to be in France, which creates the whole plot of the movie. And I think that that's just like getting there. Like, this is awesome. Like, you really thought this out. This was not a rush job.
We didn't really comment on, but like the passing theme of gentrification and Not Okay, where like there's that same homeless woman in like five different shots, and she finally gives her what that like teeth whitening scam bullshit from the party.
It's like, what the fuck can I do with this?
It's just totally not addressed, right? It's just like a theme because they live in Bushwick or whatever. And yeah, that's funny because the other film, because Mainstream is just all set in West Hollywood, right? So like the interior of this like poor girl who's barely making it as like a waitress, like the interior of her apartment is like pretty fucking nice, and it's like, this doesn't fit at all, right? Like, who are these people that are like, oh, I'm so poor, look at my fucking 1200 foot fucking square apartment in West Hollywood, like, get fucked, dude.
Yeah, I also think it's really, I wish we had said this earlier, but I do think it's really interesting that in Not Okay, it opens up with Danny getting a piece she wrote rejected because she says that like her family was out of town during 9/11, and so she didn't really, she's like, I don't know anyone who died in 9/11. I feel like I totally missed it. It's supposed to be the traumatic experience that defines our generation. And so yet she like leans into being like, oh yeah, I was totally a part of a terrorist attack. So she's just like so removed from everything.
There's a little bit of that, you know, being offended for somebody else, because her editor says that, like, isn't this pretty tone deaf? And it's like, bitch, fucking 9/11 was like 23 years ago.
Well,
like, offended on whose part? But she's like correctly pointing out that it's tone deaf. Other people are going to take offense to it, not necessarily victims of 9/11.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're all going to be like, ooh, that's in fucking bad taste, but to say, right?
Even then, when the editor says, like, isn't this tone deaf? Danny's response is, Well, can't Tone Deaf be like a brand?
girl, you got a grift on the right for that one to work.
She did say, like, I could be like Lena Dunham. And her boss's like, you don't want to be like Lena Dunham.
Or Steven Crowder or somebody, right? Like, you could probably go get a job at, what's the Ben Shapiro outfit?
Daily Caller.
You could probably go get a job at the Nashville think tank for like Zionist conservatism or whatever, right? That like Ben Shapiro runs.
Oh, by the way. Did you, and I might send this to you so you could possibly include it as part of the episode, but did you happen to see what Nancy Pelosi said about the TikTok bill?
Awesome. Awesome.
You saw it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tic-tac-toe.
Tic-tac-toe. A winner. Incredible.
Tic-tac-toe. A winner.
All right.
Well, we're losers for having watched these fucking movies.
All right. I'm going to stop to record on my end.
Okay.